Okay, we're now going on record officially. I cannot ascertain for certain whether manicures and pedicures are in fact common enough to take them out of the category of Beged Isha. In any event, it seems to me that even if it's not a strict violation of the Isur Beged Isha, Ein Ruach HaChamim Nocha Imenu. It's not a proper thing to do, and I believe that it should not be done. This is an absolute violation of Beged Isha. It's uncertain, depends on how widespread this practice is among men. Question 4. Can one attend a funeral in a conservative or reformed temple? Strictly speaking, it should be permissible, even though it may be prohibited to go into a reform or conservative temple when they are having services, because you should not be part of a services in a mixed seating place. At the same time, if you go there when there are no services, just a funeral, strictly speaking, I do not believe it's a violation. A Rav in his own Kehillah, maybe even Balabatim in their own Kehillah, there are those who do not go in to reform a conservative shul or temples in their community as a matter of policy. I have to be honest, I have that same policy. I've been in Riverdale for over 40 years, haven't been in the reform temple or the conservative synagogue. I feel it's an important getter to not allow the lines to be blurred between Orthodox and non-Orthodox. That's in my own community. In a different community, I don't believe that the prohibition extends, because then I'm going not as the rabbi of my own community, especially if I'm going to a funeral, not as a rav, but as a relative or friend. That would be even less objectionable. But even as a rav, it could be done, if I'm not mistaken, in a time of Shas Adchak. I believe that if a member of your synagogue has a funeral out of town and it's being done in a conservative by a conservative rabbi, there's even more room to be lenient if it's in a funeral chapel, not in the conservative synagogue proper. In the synagogue of conservative as a rabbi is a little bit more questionable, but maybe B'Shas HaTorah Gadol will be allowed as well. It's preferred, if a rabbi is coming, he should just be in the audience. He should not be a participant in a funeral in a conservative or reformed temple. And even if it's done in a chapel by a conservative rabbi, it's still preferred to be in the audience. Question 5. Reasoning my Kehillah out of
Rebbe, before we continue.
Yes.
Rebbe, before we continue, I have to push one button. I'm very sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay, Rebbe, you can continue. I'm sorry.
Okay, question number 5. Recently, my Kehillah had a painful email experience when one well-meaning but indiscreet congregant posted an engagement breakup on the listserv before the Balei Simcha could share it up properly with their friends. Applying the laws of Lashon Hara and Rechilas to email are not always so simple, but I would like to give a shiur on it to make people more sensitive and aware of the potential issues and pitfalls when they share information or forward emails. Can I provide some guidance in applying these halachas to email usage? I have one question. Why is it not simple? It's very simple. If there's an Easter of Lashon Hara or Rechilas, it applies to email, I would say, B'kal v'chomer, for two reasons. Number one, many people are receiving it at the same time. And number two, once it's received, it lasts forever. Even if you take it off your email and someone else has it, it's you can't retrieve it. It's much worse than verbal Lashon Hara or Rechilas. A person should not be publicizing information, whether he's the first one to publicize it or whether he's forwarding someone else who already publicized it improperly. It's prohibited. At least Lashon Hara, at least Rechilas. You want to know all the details of these prohibitions, you got to look in the Sefer Shmiras HaLashon, Sefer Chafetz Chaim. Seems to me that the answer is pretty simple, that whatever is prohibited to be said in a verbal fashion is even more prohibited to be said either by yourself initially or to forward what someone else already said in the email world. Question 6. A local family is hosting as a boarder a sincere, reliable woman who is not yet Jewish but is in a Geirus program. The mother of the family is leaving town to Eretz Yisrael for a week, leaving the father home with the boarder and a teenage daughter. What should the protocol be for Yichud? One, during the day, if they might be together in the house at the same time when the daughter is not home. Two, at night, daughter is in the house, is daughter in the house sufficient to avoid Yichud concern? The first question, absolute Easter of Yichud. No, there's certainly an Easter of Yichud, even though it's daytime. The way out of it is that try to avoid they shouldn't be in the house at the same time at all. If that's impossible, when they're both in the house, he should make sure to sit in the front room where he can be seen clearly from the outside by removing any curtains or drapes or blinds. So if he sits in the front room and everyone can see him, that is not considered to be a violation of Yichud. If that's impossible, if you leave the door wide open, it may be a possible hefter as well. But they should be very careful about this. Second part of the question, if you look at Rav Moshe, Evan Ezra Chelek Bey Simon Tetzvav, he makes the following statement. The Shulchan Aruch says that if a man and his wife are in a Yichud situation with another woman, so a man, a wife, and another woman, so the Gemara has an expression that's called in Shulchan Aruch, Ishto Mishamroso. His wife watches over him. Therefore, it's permissible, if normally one man and two women is not allowed, if one of the women is his wife, it's okay. Rav Moshe quotes an opinion of, I think it's Chol Avram, that says it only applies to a wife, does not apply to a daughter, even though, of course, Yichud with a daughter is permissible. Rav Moshe disagrees, and he says the same way as it's permissible to be in the room with one's wife and a strange woman, so too it's permissible to be in the room with one's daughter and a strange woman. So it's a machlokes on this very point. Since Rav Moshe is mekel, and this far sounds good to us, there's room to be mekel me'ikar adin. Nonetheless, all precautions should be taken. The best precaution should be taken is that if they have a border, it means they probably have a big house, so the father's room and the daughter's room should be very close to each other, and the border's room should be very far away, as much as far as can be done. For example, if the father and the daughter are upstairs, the border should be in the basement, far away, so there should be no pitfalls, chas v'shalom. Question number 7. Can a girl before bat mitzvah check her own eggs for blood spots while baking? Are there guidelines for the emunos in a pre-bar bat mitzvah status? Well, blood spots are an interesting example. Rav Moshe's Shuv, I believe it's Yerodeh Chelek Aleph Simon Lamed Vav. He says, even if you find the blood spot, the egg is permissible nonetheless. In the olden days, a blood spot indicated fertilization, which of course makes the egg treif. But today, Rav Moshe writes, given our situation, our reality, there are no more fertilized eggs on the market as a general rule. If it sneaks through, it's a fluke. They're candled and they made sure that anything which is fertilized is not brought to market. Again, human error is possible, but as a rule, it's almost impossible for it to appear in your grocery store. And therefore, Rav Moshe writes, even if you see a blood egg, egg is kosher. Now, not everyone accepts this. I remember once a story of my, it happened to me personally when I was a chassan. So my in-laws came uptown to the yeshiva to take care of some issues. They went to eat lunch in the eatery across from the old main building of the yeshiva. And someone ordered eggs. And they cracked the egg, and they didn't look. They just cracked the egg and put it straight into the pan. And my late father-in-law was, how could that be? They're not checking for blood. Apparently, that checking for blood is still very, very alive and well in many circles. But according to Rav Moshe's Tshuva, it's not really necessary. Now, I tell you another interesting story. This goes back even earlier than that. A year before I was a chassan, I was learning in Boston with Rav Soloveitchik, Zichron of the Bracha. We ended up for a period of time in a house together with the sons, two older sons of Rabbi Moshe David Tendler Shalita, which means I think the two oldest grandsons of, or among the oldest grandsons of Rav Moshe, Zichron Levrach. And they were making eggs, and they found blood in the egg. So they all knew their grandfather's tshuva that the egg is kosher. There was a big dispute between the two brothers. One brother quoted the grandfather as saying, the egg is kosher, you take out the blood, throw the blood out, and the egg is kosher. The other grandson said, no, the Zaidi said, the Rav Moshe said, the blood is also kosher. No need to even to remove the blood. That was what was going on a long time ago. In any event, in the situation that we're describing, even if the blood in and of itself would be prohibited, if the pre-bas mitzvah girl doesn't check the eggs for blood properly and you assume the blood is prohibited, it's still batel b'shishin by a long shot, and therefore there's no problem with having a check for the eggs as a chumra, because strictly speaking, the blood in the egg wouldn't be a problem. Generally speaking, though, there is no nemanis for someone under the age of bar bas mitzvah, but, you know, there are certain other rules and regulations. A milsa davida legluye, if it can be determined later on that whether the person was telling the truth, there's more room to rely upon someone under bar bas mitzvah. In the old days in Europe, they would always often send a child with a shayla to the rav, and the rav would come back with a tshuva that's mutter, it's not treif or whatever it may be, and they would trust the child because it was avida legluye. They can go back to the rav and say, "What did you tell my child?" So this is something which can be extended to other cases where there are other rules of nemanus which would apply, even though the strict nemanus of Erecha Nemen Bisturim would perhaps not apply to a child under Bar Bas Mitzvah. Question number 8. In the sugya of silk screen Sifrei Torah, is the topic just encountered in Daf Yomi, Gittin 9, that witness signing through a stencil process is not called writing, except by Aguna, Gittin 19a, Choshen Mishpat 45.4, relevant. That case of witnesses is certainly more like writing than silk screening, as it was done letter by letter with the utensil, and the Gemara maintains that it is generally not accepted. You know, the silk screen Sefer Torah controversy is a few years old already. There is a single opinion which maintains that it's kosher, and that's a printed opinion. The consensus view is that it's not kosher. Rabbi Bleich has a long piece about it in one of his books on contemporary halachic problems, and others have written about it as well. Lemaisa, to my knowledge, there's no one in the world who relies upon silk screen Sefer Torah, even though there's one famous Rav who has many unique shittas who maintains that it's okay. It's not the accepted psak. Question number 9. Is it permissible to assist a non-Jew with cooking a non-kosher meal? No actual non-kosher will be handled by the Jewish person, but rather tasks like chopping vegetables will be done. Does it make a difference what the reason for the meal is? Office get-together, holiday party, or other occasion person's job? If there are non-observant people that will be participating in that meal and eating non-kosher, is it worse to assist in such preparations? Okay. An excellent question. Look, if there's no reason whatsoever to get involved, the person shouldn't get involved. But if it's necessary, let's say, for example, a person's job, that's one possibility. Or, you know, these office get-togethers where it's important for your promotion or for the goodwill in the office that you participate somehow or other in this kind of a party, then it would be permissible to chop the vegetables. There's no Easter of Lifnei Iver, Osita and Michshol. Even if the individuals are ultimately going to eat a non-kosher meal, which will have your chopped up vegetables as part of it, because after all, they can eat the non-kosher meat without the vegetables, and therefore, it's not what's called trei ivrei denara. Other people can also give them vegetables. So there are two reasons for which it's not lifnei iver osita michshol proper with respect to the eating of the non-kosher meat, for example. For that reason itself, perhaps the individual is not even called a mesayel de ovri avera, which is a lower level. If it's chad ivrei denara, the same side of the river, you should still not be helping other people commit a violation. There are leniencies in Yerodea about a Messiah. Some say it does not apply to a non-religious person, such as the case we're discussing right now. There are other leniencies. But maybe it's even more than that. I want to make the following interesting observation. What will happen if the fellow will not cut the vegetables? So one of two things. Someone else cut the vegetables. Or there'll be no vegetables. Now, if there'll be no vegetables, a person has a certain quota of how much he or she will eat for lunch at the party. A certain amount. If there are no vegetables there, they're likely to eat more non-kosher meat. So by chopping more and more vegetables, there's a chance you're reducing the amount of non-kosher meat that will be imbibed by the non-religious Jewish person. So to the contrary, the question was raised, is it permissible, one could argue it's even advisable, because if you don't cut the vegetables, they'll be eating more kosher meat, non-kosher meat. If you cut the vegetables, they'll have more vegetables, they'll be eating less non-kosher meat. So Bekivega and Simon Yordea, Simon Kuf Pe Aleph Sivov, says exactly that. That if you are Messiah, someone to do an Aveira. But if you wouldn't, he'd do a worse Aveira. That's not an Issa Messiah at all. Rosh Shlomo Zalman quotes this in Mincha Shlomo Chelek Aleph at the end. For that reason, he says that if someone comes to your house and there are more rights in Or HaChaim, if he's not going to wash the hands from the Tzilas Yadayim, we're not going to make a bracha, shouldn't give him any food. So Rosh Shlomo Zalman says, the fear is, if you won't give him any food, he'll be resentful of Orthodox Jews. He'll be in violation of Issa D'Oraisa, of Lo Sista Tachicha B'Lavavecha. If you give him the food, worst case scenario, he won't make a bracha, he won't wash his hands. I said, the Rabbanan. Better he should be in violation of the Rabbanan than in violation of the D'Oraisa. And therefore, he thinks there's no Issa Messiah, the Deovri Avera, in such a circumstance. That may apply here as well. Question number 10. Can one put up hot water right before Shabbos? If yes, is it better to cover the spigot of the urn, parentheses, similar to covering the knobs as a prevention of hastening the cooking, because removing water will hasten the heating of the water? Strictly speaking, it's permissible to put up the water just before Shabbos, strictly speaking. Yes, it's true. If you remove some water before the water boils, you'll be in violation. If you have not yet found a gzera to aser putting up food just before Shabbos, whenever there's no possibility of adjusting the fire, such a gzera was never made. If there's a possibility of adjusting the fire, it's called the Easter of Shehiyah. This is put up before Shabbos. There cannot be such an Easter. Most urns today are non-adjustable. There's no Shem Yichata B'Gacholim whatsoever. Maybe he'll remove some water before it boils. That's true, but Chazal never made such a gzera. Nonetheless, if a person wants to take an extra measure of precaution and cover the spigot of the urn with something to prevent them to inadvertently turn the spigot before the water is fully cooked. And when it's cooked, sometimes you can see that a light goes on, or you can hear it's boiling. Sometimes you can just by the time alone, you can figure out when it's completely cooked. That would be a good idea to, again, cover the spigots. It's not obligatory, but an even better idea, a much better idea, is to see to it that the water cooks before Shabbos. That's a much better idea. So, that's what you should do. If by some mistake it was forgotten, you put it on before Shabbos. It's a good idea to cover the spigot with a cup or something else, so at least for the first hour or so that the water may not be fully cooked, but you'll be reminded not to take the water out of the urn. Question number 11. Can a person use maaser money as a gift for their child's Rebbe for Hanukkah, etc.? Unfortunately, nearly all yeshivas don't pay their Rebbes a living wage. A living wage for the Rebbe to support his very often large family. It's just not enough salary. Even if his wife works, it's still not enough. Therefore, the person is a person in need. A person in need, of course, it's permissible to give maser to that Rebbe, because that's stucca. We don't want to couch it as stucca. We'll couch it as a Hanukkah bonus, Hanukkah geld. But in reality, since it's not mandatory, it would be considered in the category of Matanos Lanir, and a beautiful use of maser money. Question 12. A shul has a shofar which is very difficult to blow and is therefore not used during Elul and Rosh Hashanah. A congregant likes that shofar and wants to take it in place of a monetary donation enough to buy a shofar. Is that allowed? Are the concerns of something that belongs to a tzibur not going to an individual? In my opinion, it's completely permissible. If the tzibur has no use for the shofar, gives them $100 for the shofar, they have 100 use for $100. That's okay. The shofar has no kedusha, no kedusha. If we have kedusha, there are poskim who maintain to take a shul and change it from a beis knesset shul rabban to beis knesset shul yochid, you're lowering the kedusha. That's the shaila mesechta megillah. But here, you're taking a shofar which has no kedusha, and it's not being blown anyway, and you're transferring its ownership to a private citizen. I see no reason why not. On the contrary, maybe this guy's citizen will even use it on Rosh Hashanah, even though it's not fit for public use. 13. Can one prepare strawberries on Shabbos? Use a salad spinner. These are obviously put together because they're both a question of borer. So the question of strawberries depends not so much on Hilchos Borer, but on Hilchos Kashrus. If you hold that strawberries, it's enough to cut off the leaf on top and to wash the strawberries, you'd wash a grape, then there's no problem. We assume it's permissible to cut off the top of any fruit, which is not going to be eaten. And it's also assumed to be permissible to rinse fruits under the water of a faucet on Shabbos. So they ask, why is that so? Why is there no Easter of Borer? So there are a number of answers which are given. Some say you can eat it without the rinsing process. Some say the dirt is external. It's not a taruvis, and therefore no taruvis is no Easter of removing psalas and mochel. Many reasons, but the general rule is to be make when it comes to pouring water on top of fruits. There are many poskim who maintain you can allow to submerge the fruits in water on Shabbos. Not everybody agrees, but if that would be the case when it comes to grapes, it would be true with respect to strawberries as well. And just by just submerging it in the water, whatever riffraff will come to the top, and you can get rid of it. That's all assuming that strawberries are like grapes. But there are some poskim who maintain that strawberries are completely infested. You have to have special ways of eliminating all the little tiny bugs in the strawberries. Who's right and who's wrong in that dispute? I'm not qualified enough to answer. I would like to quote the late Rav Eitan Henkin, Hashem Yimkom Domo, was a beautiful kuntras called Lechem Yil Achla, all about bugs. And he did experiments in there to show with the strawberries. And my recollection is that regular strawberries that were brought to market, the incidence of bugs was extremely low, what we call in our language a miyut she'eino motzui, or a single-digit minority, which is halakhically inconsequential. You don't have to even check for it. However, organic strawberries, which is, you know, more natural, and they had a higher incidence, as well as the strawberries which were coming from our non-Jewish neighbors who weren't as clean as the actual Israeli strawberries. That's what he reported in his carefully done study. It emerges that if the strawberries in America are fairly clean, then it would be permissible to eat the strawberries with a simple cutting off of the top where most of the bugs are. Most of us don't eat the green part of the strawberry anyway. So cut off that top and you rinse it off with water like any other fruit, it would be permissible. A salad spinner. So here, it all depends. A salad spinner, generally speaking, as I understand it, is you have lettuce is soaked in water, and then you put the lettuce in the spinner, and the spinner knocks out most of the water, and you have the lettuce, which is not so wet, it's mostly dry. If it's, I use the word mostly dry, but there is some water still mixed in together with the lettuce, that's permissible. Rabbi Moshe has a tshuva about that too. It's an original form written to Rabbi Eider. It's on page 195 of his first volume on Hilchos Shabbos in the Melacha of Borer Merake. It's also printed in Chelek Dal of the Or HaChaim. And he says the same way as if you remove some impurities and you leave some, and you could have consumed it with all the impurities there, we pass on its mutter. It's called Mishnah Sibahachi. It would be drinking it. It's a Sugi Masech to Shabbos, Kuf Lamates, Kuf Mem, that area. So too over here, if you're going to leave, you want to leave a little bit in. In Moshe's case, you want to leave a little bit of coleslaw or some liquids therein. You want to leave a little bit in. It would be mutter to use what he calls there a salad spoon, which is very similar to a salad spinner. And therefore, I would say, if you want to leave some of the water in, it would be permissible. If you want to get it bone dry, then it would be a problem. You should not use a salad spinner. Finally, 14. Would it be permissible to set a dishwasher with a Shabbos clock and load the dishes while the machine is off and unload them when it is done? Very serious problem. We walk into a room, we see a dishwasher, and it looks like you close it. It's not, you haven't accomplished anything when you close it. It's just a mechanical thing, a technical thing. Nothing has been changed. That's completely incorrect. Because of safety regulations, every single dishwasher that I know about in this country has to have a safety device which engages, which locks the machine, completes the circuit, and enables the machine to go on either immediately or if it's set on the timer, when the timer kicks in. So in other words, unbeknownst to the average individual, when you lock the dishwasher, either by closing it shut, or in the olden days by turning a lever to the right, which then closes it shut, what you're in effect doing is literally flicking a switch. In the same way, as La Halacha L'Maisa, we would not flick a switch on the light, even if the light's not going to go on for another 3 hours with the Shabbos clock. We consider that to be prohibited. The nature of the prohibition is not completely clear. According to Shlomo Zalman in Mincha Shlomo, Chelik Aleph Siman Yud Gimel, maybe it's considered to be grumma, maybe it's worse than grumma. My rabbi considered it to be much worse than grumma because what you're doing is working in tandem with the Shabbos clock. And what we call Koach Acha Me'urbo, you and some other force are working together, and they're working together at the same time that you begin what you're doing. That's considered to be a malacha proper and not merely grumma. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman is mesupik about it. Even according to the lenient side of his suffix, it's still presumably no less than Easter of grama, which is prohibited. Shalom b'makom hefsed gadol, such as a sreifa the Gemara has, or the Ramon and some shin lama dalet. And therefore, one may not close the dishwasher or turn the little lever in the front of the dishwasher on Shabbos or Yontif, because you're simply completing a circuit which enables the machine to go on at a later time. And when it goes on, it boils water and does all kinds of prohibited activities, which you don't want to have any connection to whatsoever. Therefore, it's not allowed. Someone once asked, can they deactivate the safety device? And then when they turn the switch, so nothing really is done because it would have gone on anyway at a later time. To which I responded, I'm not going to allow someone to turn off a safety switch on a device which exists in millions of American installations, dishwashers, millions. I believe it's required by law because they're afraid of danger. Now, I wasn't so afraid of the danger in the very beginning. When you asked me in the first question about the CSS, that danger I wasn't so worried about. But the danger of a dishwasher with the safety device deactivated, to me, is very frightening. A little kid walks by, and the water is going, and he pulls open the dishwasher, and the water, instead of stopping, which it does with the safety device, will just keep on going. Chas v'chalil, the person could become burned by the hot water coming out. I would never allow such a situation because of the potential danger. And you say, well, come on. You have to think 10 years ahead. Maybe in your present circumstances, it's unlikely. But when you buy the dishwasher, and you're getting used to this kind of an activity of deactivation of a safety device, it can come back to haunt you years later. And I don't want to be part of any such thing. I'm a machmir pikuach nefesh. I want to emphasize that my answer to my first question is not made out of a lack of concern for pikuach nefesh. I'm a talmud of my rebbe, the rav who was the grandson of Reb Chaim, said he's not a mekel in Shabbos Yom Kippur. He's a machmir pikuach nefesh. I feel very much in that school. However, going back to the first question, since it's so over the top with the videos, with the smartphones, with the walkie-talkies, I feel that it's really not warranted by the present situation, even post San Bernardino and ISIS. And once again, if the members of the synagogue are so concerned about the security, they should hire a non-Jewish guard. And they'll say, but he doesn't know who's part of the shul, so someone should volunteer to stand right next to him. And someone who's suspicious, should stop. And someone who we know is a member of the community should be allowed in. Maybe I'll just go quickly over the other questions which weren't recorded very quickly. Question two, discussing neither shilas. To make a long story short, it's hard to know. It's up to the Rav to try to find out. This Adam Gadol that we're discussing, whether his psukim are what we'll call the mainstream of halacha, and therefore, if he is, and others want to go to a Rabbi X who's more lenient, that means X is out of the mainstream, and the rabbi can certainly not recommend to go to X. If they want to go to X on their own, that's their business. On the contrary, if the Adam Gadol is found to be more machmir than the mainstream psak, and it's hard to find these things out, but it's the rabbi's job, then he's permitted to take his shilas to a different rav, and maybe even X is in that category. The manicure and pedicure for men, we said, depends upon how common it is. It's an Issa Begadisha. And the funeral in the Conservative Reform Temple, which is the last question, I think, before you went online, on recording, I should say, we suggested that if it's not during davening, there's no complete prohibition. Nonetheless, there are many individuals, especially Rabbanim, who will not go into a non-Orthodox synagogue or temple in their own communities. I think it's a very wise policy. Some communities that policy is not accepted by leading Rabbanim. And for example, we're talking here about funerals, because the same thing may apply to weddings. I wouldn't go into a wedding or bar mitzvah in my own community, because I would urge others not to. But in other communities where the rabbis are going in anyway, I would go to do a wedding or attend a wedding, even if there's no mechitza there. So too with respect to a funeral, in another community I would go. Certainly as a private citizen, going to a relative or friend's funeral, parent's funeral. And even as a Rav, I would go if necessary. We should try to remain passive participants. And there's more leniency to be extended in a case, again, out of town, where the funeral is being arranged and presided over by a non-Orthodox rabbi when it's taking place in a funeral chapel and not in a non-Orthodox shul. Thank you very much. Anybody there?
Rabbi, it's Binyamin. First question I don't think was recorded as well. The one about security services for volunteering.
But I reviewed that.
Okay, maybe I missed it. Okay, thank you.
Okay,
Rabbi, thank you very, very much. I apologize for the recording. Take care. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.